and welcome to this podcast from Control Risks. Today we're talking about virtual kidnapping. It's a crime which involves an extortionist contacting someone by telephone, claiming falsely to have kidnapped one of their relatives before then demanding a ransom for their release. It's a common crime across much of Latin America, including Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina. But today I'm joined by Joseph Smith, one of our special risks analysts, to talk about the threat it poses in the United States. Joe, as I was saying, this is common across Latin America. Why the emphasis on the US?
Yes, it certainly is traditionally or even principally associated with Latin America, but it is also very common in the US. I see it very widely reported on in the country. I'm constantly seeing reports of individual incidents, reports from local police departments about the threat that it poses. But despite how common it is and despite how much media coverage it gets, the main reason that I want to talk about it today is that most people still don't know anything about it, and so it continues to thrive. I think that that's probably partly because of the fact that a lot of the media coverage that it gets is in local press, or a lot of the coverage that it gets is from local police forces. And so it's always presented as being a new issue which is emerging within sort of an individual town or an individual county, rather than being part of a nationwide problem.
So from your research, are you able to discern just how widespread the problem is?
It always used to be a crime which was most focused around the south or the southwest of the country, and then it gradually started to spread up the east coast. But back in October last year, the FBI actually released a report indicating that it had now developed into a nationwide problem, such that pretty much anyone anywhere could potentially fall victim to it. So although we still see the largest numbers of incidents in southern states, the likes of Texas, also the southwest, such as California, we are starting to see it recorded much more evenly all over the country. The main reason for that, I guess, is that it's a crime which doesn't really rely on its perpetrators being located anywhere near their targets, as is obviously the case with a kidnap for ransom, where the kidnapper actually needs to physically take hold or take captive their victims. Instead, a virtual kidnapper will contact their targets over the telephone and normally demand ransom payments by wire transfer systems such as Western Union or MoneyGram, meaning that they can target anyone anywhere in the country. In fact, they can target people across borders. So we actually see a large proportion of virtual kidnap calls targeting the US actually coming out of Mexico.
And does the fact that many of the calls come from Mexico mean there are similarities between the crime there and the crime north of the border?
Definitely, yes. There are big crossovers in terms of tactics, and virtual kidnappers are normally looking to secure a payment as quickly as possible before the scam unravels, and they will use very similar methodologies to that end. A particularly common tactic pretty much everywhere where we see this crime involves extortionists pretending to be the victim themselves and crying or whimpering in the background during the calls, just to add extra pressure and urgency to their demands and threats during these calls and to ensure a quick payment. We also see some of the more sophisticated tactics from Mexico spreading across the border as well, such as the tactic of targeting hotel guests and forcing them to isolate themselves before then contacting their relatives and demanding a ransom for their release. But beyond that, there are also some different sophisticated versions which are specific to both the United States and also to Mexico.
And so what are these specific versions which have developed in the US virtual kidnap scene?
Well, as just to use the comparison with Mexico, as kidnapping for ransom is common in Mexico, virtual kidnapping can be highly credible. Obviously, in the United States, kidnapping for ransom is significantly less common, so sometimes the extortionists will try and develop slight variations on the same scam in order to reel in their targets and just to make it more believable in the local context. One of the more common tactics that I see is for the extortionist to claim that their target's son or daughter has been involved in or has caused a traffic accident, and then to escalate or to develop the story around that, perhaps first by claiming that they want to settle the issue financially without involving the authorities or the insurance providers, before gradually getting more and more angry and then eventually claiming that they're going to actually take the son or daughter captive, take them hostage, and their demand for compensation becomes quickly a demand for a ransom. Another variation that we sometimes see in the US that is slightly different from what we see in Mexico involves the extortionist contacting a man and claiming to have kidnapped his wife, before then calling the wife and claiming to have kidnapped her husband and demanding a ransom from both of them individually. But the idea is that by keeping them both on the phone simultaneously, the couple aren't able to contact each other and therefore to realise that it's a scam, so that they're much more likely to end up believing in it and paying a ransom.
So there are clearly a lot of fairly sophisticated techniques and strategies used, but why is it not obvious that it's a scam, especially if a call's coming from abroad?
Well, interestingly, I have actually seen some evidence of extortionists targeting the US using software or phone applications that can conceal their caller ID, or just to give the impression that they're using a local telephone number when in fact they're calling from abroad. And that can obviously make the scam a lot more credible, because it gives the impression that the extortionist is actually located near to their target. But as a general point, I think it's worth highlighting that virtual kidnappers will only need a fraction of these attempts to be successful for the crime to remain profitable. And even when their attempts aren't successful and the targets don't make a ransom payment, virtual kidnaps can still have a significant traumatic or disruptive impact.
And is there any pattern in who is targeted by this sort of scam?
On the whole, most virtual kidnappers, both in the US and elsewhere, select their targets pretty much at random by dialing consecutive numbers, either that they've found on the internet or that they've found from telephone directories. So you often see it in the US, a spate of incidents reported in a specific county or town over the course of just a few hours or days before the crime then crops up somewhere else. And that basically means that absolutely anyone anywhere can be targeted. I'm certainly aware of incidents involving employees of large firms, of large multinationals. In fact, about this time last year, an officer at the New York Police Department alleged that employees at the highest levels of Fortune 500 companies had been affected by this crime. But that said, as extortionists will typically claim to have kidnapped a child, it's obviously parents who are most likely to believe the scam, especially when they're separated from their children, so during the school or the working day.
And finally, looking forward, are we seeing any kind of trend as to the way this crime might be evolving in the US?
It's a crime that is incredibly difficult to crack down on. I'm only aware of a couple of arrests on US soil related to this crime. And indeed, most of its perpetrators operate with relative impunity, often because, as we've discussed, they can be based outside of the country. Essentially, I would say that the only impediment to its spreading further is raising public awareness. And without that, I'd suggest it's just going to keep moving and spreading around the country and affecting more people.
Okay, thanks very much. We'll wrap it up there. That was Joseph Smith, one of our special risks analysts here at Control Risks. Thank you, Joseph, and thank you
for listening to this podcast. You can always find out more about what we're up to at Control Risks by visiting our website, controlrisks.com. Bye for now.